It would mean so much to me because I am a crippled girl and have spent all my life in a wheelchair. I rode the wildest horse in the stable. I was dragged, but I did not die, thanks to my guardian angel. I wish I could run and play like the other children, but at least I am glad that Daddy Dear can wheel me to the picture house so I can see you. Thank you. Yours truly. Frances muses for a moment, and then it comes to her. Who the letter is from, that is. She signs it, tucks it into the envelope, and addresses it to Miss Gish's fan club in Hollywood, California. Then she looks up at Lily, who has been waiting obediently for playtime to begin, and says, "All right, Lily, come with me." Lily follows Frances up to the attic. "I was going to show you something, but now I think maybe you're not old enough." "I am, Frances. I'm old." They are seated on the floor, cross-legged before the hope chest. "This was Kathleen's room, eh, Frances?" always must be said, and the response, "That's right, Lily. This is where she died." Before they can get on with whatever game Frances has in mind. This liturgy serves to honor the story that no longer needs repeating. The story that Frances told Lily so long ago and so often. Our beautiful older sister Kathleen. She had red hair like an angel on fire. She had the voice of an angel. God loved her so much, he took her. She was only 19 when she died of the flu. I was there when she died, and I closed her eyes. There is always a pause here while they both picture it faithfully. Then Frances continues. Her last words were, "Dear Frances, you are my favorite sister, and you are also the most beautiful next to me. Please look after Lily." Frances's eyes start to glint green, but it is a serious glint. Scary. Lily's eyes grow round and wet. The bump appears in her forehead. "Why did she say look after me?" Frances doesn't take her eyes off Lily. She just says evenly, "Because she loved you, Lily."
"I love her, too."
Tears. Frances puts out a hand and barely strokes Lily's long hair that's never been cut. Then, "Okay, quit blubbering. Let's play." It is understood that Kathleen is not to be mentioned around Daddy. Because, Lily, it would hurt him terribly if you even said her name. On this particular evening, Frances has decided that the time has come to talk of other things. She reaches into her pocket and produces the key to the hope chest. Lily gasps. "Don't be so melodramatic, Lily."
"What's melodramatic?"
"It's stupid."
"Oh."
Frances repockets the key.
"I made a mistake."
"You're too young."
"I am not."
"Keep your voice down," whispering passionately.
"I am not, Frances. I won't tell."
Frances raises an eyebrow, shakes her head, mutters,
"I must be losing my marbles,"
and inserts the key into the lock, raises the lid. The waft of cedar. Frances gets a lump in her throat, blinks past it. Lily knows better than to ask.
"Close your eyes, Lily."
"Okay." "There are things in here that you're not ready to see." Rustle, rustle. "Put your hand out." Lily does.
"It feels silky."
"It's pure satin." "Open your eyes." Frances holds what looks like a miniature wedding gown, gone a little yellow with age.
"It's beautiful,"
Lily breathes. "It's the christening gown. We were all baptized in it. Kathleen, Mercedes, me, you, and Ambrose." Lily looks up.
"Who's Ambrose?"
The thin white stripe appears across the bridge of Frances's nose. It usually only appears when she's laughing, but she's not laughing now.
"He's your brother, Lily."
Lily stays perfectly quiet, looking into Francis's eyes, waiting. Francis says, "Here, you can hold it." Lily takes the gown from Francis and cradles it in her arms. Such a precious thing, an heirloom. Francis says, "Ambrose died." Lily waits, listens. Francis tells the story. "On the day you both were born, a stray orange cat came in through the cellar door. It climbed the cellar steps. It climbed the front hall steps. It climbed all the way up to the attic without a sound. It came in here where you both were sleeping, and it leaped into your crib. It put its mouth over Ambrose's face and sucked the breath out of him. He turned blue and died. Then the orange cat put its paws on your chest, and it was about to do the same thing to you, but I came in and I saved you. Daddy took the orange cat and drowned it in the creek. Then he buried it in the garden, in the spot where the scarecrow used to be, but now there's a stone. I helped." Lily doesn't move a muscle. Francis takes the gown carefully from her and calls, "Here, Trixie," making kissing sounds with her mouth. "Come on, Trixie, come on," until they hear the loping pad-pad up the stairs, and Trixie appears in the room. "Blink, you called?" "That's a good Trixie. Come here." Trixie comes. She always does when Francis calls. She found Francis 3 years ago. Trixie is pure black with yellow eyes. Although, who can say? Maybe her missing front paw had a white slipper on it. We'll never know. "Francis, Lily, supper. Coming, Mercedes." Downstairs, Mercedes pops her head out the front door, looking for Daddy's Hupmobile. He had to do an emergency delivery to Glace Bay this afternoon. Someone needed 20 pairs of shoes right away. Mercedes is proud that Daddy works so hard, and always at night just so he can look after Lily. Otherwise, Mercedes would have had to leave school. Daddy drives all over the island delivering dry goods he picks up in Sydney, and often he makes boots all night in the shed. Mercedes has seen the reassuring glow of his lamp down there in the window, although she would never dream of disturbing him. Daddy doesn't like to be interrupted when he's working. Mercedes is proud they have an automobile, although she knows she should only be grateful. Here it comes, right on schedule, long and boxy, bobbing over the ruts. And here come the girls down from the attic. It looks as though supper will be on time for once. Tonight, it's an old Cape Breton recipe that Mercedes got from Mrs. McIsaac. Cion gruppi. That's Gaelic for stuffed cod head. It's taken Mercedes all afternoon. She sincerely hopes Daddy will be thrilled. Take a big cod head. Take a lot of cod livers. Scrape off the iffy bits. Take rolled oats, cornmeal, flour, and salt. Stuff the head through the mouth, holding it with a finger in each eye. Boil. James tosses his cap onto the hall tree hook and says, "Come and hit the ivories, Mercedes. I feel like cutting the rug with my best girl." Mercedes smiles at Daddy and proceeds obediently to the front room, forced to wait dinner after all. Tortured as though by tacit conspiracy involving her entire family, she sits at the piano and grits her teeth at the sound of Lily giggling and running to Daddy. Mercedes opens the old "Let us have music for piano" and plays. Lily places her left foot on top of Daddy's right one, her right one on his left, and they dance to Roses of Picardy. Until finally, "I'm starved," says Daddy. "What's for supper, Mercedes?" "Supper. You've got to be kidding," says Francis. Even James. "I'm sure it's delicious, Mercedes, but I have a hard time eating with my dinner looking me straight in the eyes." They all laugh except Mercedes, who gets up and leaves the room. "What's the matter with her?" asks James. Frances responds, "It's her period." James winces, so sorry to have inquired that he fails to notice the inappropriateness of the answer. "Well, I'll apologize. Who wants tea biscuits and molasses?" Up in her room, Mercedes consoles herself with the family tree. She has been working on it for almost a year. It is a painstaking process. Whenever she has a new entry, whenever she has had the precious time to dig a little deeper in the Sydney library, or on those rare occasions when she has received a long-awaited reply from the provincial archives in Halifax, she carefully unrolls the large scroll of special paper on her desk. She fastens down the corners, takes out a pencil and a ruler, and neatly draws a short vertical line beneath one of several long horizontal ones, under which she inscribes the latest name. And there it hangs, quietly suspended like a piece of desiccated fruit. Mercedes' patience for this task is unlimited. She plans to surprise Daddy with it. He never talks about his own family, except to say they all died. Perhaps she can restore to Daddy a fragment of what he has lost. After supper on this evening, Lily comes up to find Mercedes going over all the pencil lines in careful ink.
"Thank you for supper, Mercedes."
Mercedes looks up sharply to see if Lily is being mean, but Lily is never intentionally cruel. Mercedes knows that and repents of her suspicion. She returns to her work and says merely, "Hmm." Lily approaches and looks over Mercedes' shoulder, fascinated.
"How come it doesn't look like a tree?"
"Tree is only an expression, Lily. If it looked like a tree, then it would be art. This is a chart."
"Like a map?"
"Kind of."
"Is there treasure?"
"Each name is a treasure."
"Where does it lead to?"
"Map is just an expression, too. It doesn't lead anywhere." Mercedes relaxes back in her chair.
"Well, maybe in a way it does. It leads into the past. It tells us where we came from. But it doesn't tell us where we're going. Only God knows that."
"Where am I?" "You're right here on the same line with me and Frances and Kathleen. God rest her soul."
"Where is other Lily?"
"She doesn't appear here, dear."
"How come?"
"She was never baptized."
"But she was our sister."
"Yes, and we love her and pray for her. But that's not how it works on a family tree."
"Where's Ambrose?"
Mercedes looks at Lily.
"Who's Ambrose?"
Lily looks back at Mercedes.
"Will you read me a story?"
"Of course I will, dear. You go climb into your nightgown and pick one out. I'll be right there." At 3 that morning, Mercedes slumbers beneath a finger of moonlight. As usual, her door is an inch or so ajar. She has nothing to hide and plenty to listen for. The door begins to open silently. Mercedes' eyes open, in time to see it swing to rest wide enough to admit a draft, or a very small child.
"Who's there?"
No answer. The soft, barely discernible pad-padding of tiny feet. Approaching the bed.
"Trixie?"
Silence. Trixie never visits her room.
"Go away, Trixie."
At the corner of Mercedes' eye, a whitish glimmer. Her blood cools. Not Trixie. Mercedes raises her head. The thing moves into the slant of moonlight. And there, oh, Mother of God, an unholy infant, swathed in a mockery of the first holy sacrament. Mercedes tries but fails to say, "Out!" Dressed in the baptismal gown, stained with the devil's swart embrace.
"Out!"
A cracked whisper, two yellow eyes.
Out, 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 out!
Straight from her bowels. James bolts through the door, flails, finds and yanks the electric light chain to see Mercedes shuddering, staring, teeth bared, rosary at her chest. What's happened? Mercedes speaks, but her sobs snatch and tear the words. He grips her shoulders. Look at me. He shakes her. Look at me. She does. She pulls herself up and away from the void, then says,
I thought I saw something.
He nods and sits down on the edge of her bed. There is and is not any such thing as a ghost. This house, for example. James, honest with himself, admits that there are places and times which he avoids in his own home. Not out of belief. Out of that spot on the back of his neck that stirs now and then for no reason. That's when he wishes he had the right to pray. Because that's what the unquiet need. Pray for us, is what they're saying with their moans and midnight walks. James runs his tongue over the dry bluish sheen of his lower lip, and Mercedes notices how long his lashes are. He speaks to her alone, oh, it seems for the first time since she was a very little girl. Your grandmother, my mother, saw something once. Or no, heard. Mercedes waits. Daddy has never mentioned his mother to anyone but me, now, at this moment. And perhaps once long ago to Kathleen. Mercedes holds her breath, not to startle the moment. So fragile. All the fine things, anything not smudged. All things that can never wither but break so easily. That's what he is. Music, he says. It was a sunny day. She couldn't tell you what instrument or what tune, or even which way it came, whether in through the window or right beside her. That's what she thought. That must be what heaven's like. It was that beautiful. So she knelt down where she was in the kitchen and said a prayer of thanks because she'd had that little taste, see? And after that, she was never afraid of anything. Mercedes forms her small smile. She holds her tears in a reservoir. Tears could only dampen a moment such as this and set it to mildew, guaranteeing its decay. A voice from the door.
What's the matter?
Hey, little buddy. James goes to Lily and scoops her up. Lily fastens her legs around his waist. She's too big to be picked up, thinks Mercedes, answering,
I thought I...
But she catches Daddy's warning look and revises her story.
Nothing, Lily. I rode the nightmare, is all. Did you see the boatikin?
James laughs at the old Gaelic expression.
There's no such thing. Who told you about the boatikin?
Francis.
Shut up, Lily. For once, can't you just shut up? But Mercedes says,
Francis was just teasing. There's no such thing. Mercedes? Want to sleep with me and Francis?
No, thank you, Lily. Give your sister a kiss goodnight, Lily. They leave, and Mercedes, thoroughly back to herself, rises and crosses to the center of the room, douses the light and returns to bed in the dark, scornfully recalling the days when she believed that long-necked creatures resided beneath her bed, waiting to bite her ankles. She kneels at the side of her bed and starts the rosary. Just in time. Because she felt the first inkling of the long-necked things just now, when her mind's disdain wore off. Beside, kneeling in the dark is always the hardest. For imagine the things wrapping themselves around your upper legs, pulling you under. Don't imagine anything past that. Nothing like that is going to happen as long as you say your rosary, with a pure heart. Mercedes despises herself for these childish superstitions, knows them to be groundless. but can't stop the retractions in her thigh muscles all the same. These small flexings often lead to a dread feeling farther up that craves undoing. And it's this feeling, more than all the others, that serves to remind one that, while there are no long-necked creatures under the bed, and the bodekin is merely a pagan notion, there is certainly a devil. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. Mercedes imagines her unknown grandmother bathed in sunlight, kneeling in thanks for the foretaste of heaven. Then she considers the visitation which she herself has just been vouchsafed. God gives us each something different. Francis is in the cellar, holding a coal-oil lamp to the gap between the furnace and the blackened wall, where Trixie is wedged as far back as possible. Trixie's lace bonnet is askew, her white satin gown a sooty mess. Earlier this evening, just before supper, she scrawled out of Francis's hold in the attic and streaked down to the cellar for refuge. Cats don't enjoy dress-ups. She stayed behind the furnace until the house fell silent. Then she crept out and up the stairs, to Mercedes' room. "Come on, Trixie!" Francis has to get Trixie undressed quickly, because if Daddy finds her like this again, it will be into the creek with her. "Trixie, please!" Trixie vigorously licks her front paw and washes her face. "Trixie! Ta'ilahon, Habibti!" Trixie looks up, then suffers herself to be hauled from the corner. Francis unties the bonnet. "You look so pretty, Trixie," and undoes the thousand buttons of the baptism gown. "Stay still, I'm almost..." Trixie scratches the rest of the way out and bounds up the steps. Francis follows more quietly. When she reaches the top step, her lamplight splashes across Daddy's shoes. Trixie is long gone, thank goodness. She'll be back in 2 or 3 days. James waits until Francis has washed and hung up the gown and bonnet. Upstairs, Mercedes finishes the rosary. Even as she screamed, her mind had already identified what she had seen, but it had to wait for her body to catch up. The apparition explained, however, is not expunged. It was a demonic vision, whatever the earthly agency. God works in mysterious ways, but the devil's ways are even more arcane and often spiced with the absurd. Some would say funny. Mercedes would not. Funny is a fat lady playing the ukulele. Funny is a man dressed up as a woman in a Gilbert and Sullivan musical. Funny is not a crippled black cat got up like a devil baby in the family christening gear at midnight. Francis is a vessel, like that morning before Mama died, and Mercedes and Francis both had coal smudges on their foreheads, and Francis said she was visited by a dark lady in the night. Please, dear Mother of God, hear my prayer and accept the offering of thy holy rosary for the preservation of the soul of my sister Francis. Amen. No sooner is Mercedes back in bed than the light slices on again, and she squints up to see Francis's head bobbing and lurching. He's got her by the back of the neck. Punch and Judy. "Now, apologize to your sister." Mercedes looks away. She can't stand it when Francis grins with a bloody lip. Later, when all is calm, Mercedes slips into the room overlooking the creek. She crawls into bed and spoons around Francis's chilled back and encircles her thin waist. On the other side, Lily feigns sleep. All the sisters tucked up in one bed. This wonderful thing only ever happens these days on sad occasions. Francis has had another talking to from Daddy. Lily knows that. Mercedes feels ease. This is as close as she gets to a state of grace, curious as she knows this to be. It is a mystery. To experience the gift of peace with your bad sister in your arms. Nothing can get you now, Francis. Te berini. Mercedes casts a net of thought prayers over Francis's sleeping form. Lighter than air, than gossamer wings, finer than the finest silk to keep my little sister safe. Hush, baby, sleep. Thy mother tends the sheep. The Family Tree. 3.5 weeks later, Mercedes has unearthed another fossil. It was beached beneath a quarter inch of dust on a forgotten page of a crumbling chapel registry. Another name, perfectly preserved in its desert grave, waiting to be exhumed and grafted onto Mercedes' family tree, granted eternal still life in a meaningful context. Late at night, when all is blessedly quiet, when she's got a moment to herself alone, she sits at her desk, straightens her spine, and begins to unscroll the family tree. She squints as though against a sudden light. It's... unscroll a little more. What is it? A riot of golds and greens and ruby reds swirls and ululates across the page. What is it? Scroll it slowly open all the way, and... where there was once a sober grid etched in ink with loving and dispassionate care, there is now a swaying, drunken growth. A what? A tree. A tree. Yes. She can see that now. It is, in fact, a tree. Colored in with crayons. Every ancient name has been obliterated by a shiny red apple. Each right angle beguiled into a serpent twist of bark. Each vertical stroke has evolved into a leafy stem bearing fruit. The largest apples strain the lower boughs all in a line. These are the only apples with names, printed in an awkward, childish hand. Daddy, Mama, Kathleen, Mercedes, Francis, Other Lily, and Lily. The Mama and Kathleen apples have little golden wings, and the Other Lily one has silver wings. Trixie's black face and yellow eyes peek out from a high branch amid emerald leaves. Meanwhile, at the base of the trunk, grass sprouts on the surface of the earth, and a little blue creek flows by all innocent of the continued drama below. For a cross-section of the earth reveals tree roots thrusting down and branching out into the surrounding soil studded with glistening chunks of coal, and worked by a sightless army of worms. And there, nestled among the pale subterranean branches, is a golden chest encrusted with diamonds. Buried treasure. Mercedes' tears fall and bead on the shiny wax colors of the newly revised edition of the family tree. She has never cried so bitterly or so quietly in all her life. People have been known to go gray or snow-white overnight due to a fright or a sudden loss of all joy. But Mercedes' hair simply fades. Francis sees it happen. She was thinking of sneaking out of the house when she passed Mercedes' door and saw her light. "Mercedes, are you awake?" Mercedes is slumped over the desk, perfectly still. Has she died? Turned to stone? To salt? Mercedes! Francis approaches, leans down, and looks. Golly Moses! How long has she been like this? Her gapped back mouth all tight and wrinkled at the corners, her eyes crunched and seeping, perfectly still. Francis touches Mercedes' shoulder, and Mercedes takes a big gulp of air, emerging from her silent picture to cry in a real-life way. What's wrong? Mercedes, what is it? What happened? Mercedes speaks from the back of her throat. I hate her. I hate her so much. I wish I could kill her. I wish it weren't a sin. I wish she were dead. I wish she had died. I hate her. Hate her. Francis understands Mercedes, and so does not embrace her, but lightly strokes her newly pale braids. What on earth is Mercedes going on about?
She wrecked everything, says Mercedes. Everyone was happy before she came along. Everyone died. Everything went wrong when she was born. She's spoiled rotten, and I'm going to have to look after her for the rest of my life because she's a cripple. Oh, God, I hate my life. I hate my life.
Mercedes sobs. Frances comforts her the way you would a dear and delicate moth, if moths could be comforted.
Shh, 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 shh. It's okay now. It's all right now. What's wrong with Mercedes?
Reverend, worried, Lily asks from the door. How long has she been standing there? How much did she hear? Frances answers gently without missing a beat.
She had a bad dream, Lily. Go back to bed.
Mercedes doesn't acknowledge Lily's presence. She just goes on crying. Lily retreats. Frances looks down at the brilliant scroll. In bed, under the covers, there is a small, unearthly glow. It emanates from a tiny grotto formed by sheets held up by Lily's knee. The source of the glow is the Virgin Mary. She is made of white phosphorescent bakelite and towers 4 inches above a tin sedan in which Lily, Frances, and Mercedes have lost their way in the middle of the night out the country. They saw a glow in the distance a little way off the road, in a farmer's field. And there she was, Our Lady. Everywhere there is the smell of Lily of the Valley. They must be right in the middle of a field of it, but it's too dark to tell. Either that, or the lovely smell is coming from her. The Blessed Virgin has a message for each of the sisters that they must never reveal, not even to one another. Lily's message is this. Her leg will never heal. It will never be like the other one. She will always have one boot leg and one good leg. There is a reason for this. Our Lady does not say what it is. Now, get back into your car and love one another.
Yes, Our Lady.
Lily. It's Frances. Oh, no. Lily has used her perfume without asking. But Frances doesn't even say anything about that. Lily. Lily drives the car away from the grotto and out from beneath the sheets. She looks up at Frances. Frances has the scroll. What happened here, Lily? Tears form in Lily's eyes and roll down, but she's not crying that she knows of.
I colored in the family tree. That was Mercedes' special thing. It was a surprise.
Now she's crying. You know you shouldn't touch other people's things, Lily, especially when they've worked hard. You should have drawn your own.
I couldn't help it.
Frances knows this to be true. She sits down on the edge of the bed.
I'm sorry, Frances.
Don't cry, Lily. Lily tumbles into Frances's arms for a good snuggling cry, and Frances hugs her.
Frances?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone didn't die.
What do you mean?
Everyone didn't die when I was born.
Of course they didn't.
Daddy didn't die. Mercedes didn't die. You didn't die.
Mercedes' feelings were hurt, that's all, Lily. She didn't mean it. She loves you. We all do. Lily can't resist another look at her artwork. She peels open the scroll and reaches under the sheets for the phosphorescent statue. She and Frances look at the scroll together by the light of the Virgin Mary. You're a good artist, Lily. I like the worms.
Thank you.
What's inside the treasure chest?
Treasure.
What kind of treasure?
Ambrose.
Lily, Ambrose is just a story.
I know.
The Virgin is losing her glow. The picture is no longer visible. It's time to go to sleep. Frances rolls up the scroll.
What are you going to do with it, Frances?
We don't want Mercedes to see it anymore. I'll have to take it to the dump or burn it.
No!
Shh! We can't keep it.
We could bury it.
Frances considers. In the garden. Frances and Lily are crouched in the garden, working by the cautious light of a candle stub. The Virgin Mary is in Lily's pocket. Together they manage to dislodge the big rock, a catastrophe for a whole community of soft-shell creatures that go scrambling in all directions. Lily marvels at how they all managed to thrive under that rock without being crushed by it.
For them, the rock is the sky.
Come on, Lily. We haven't got all night. Even though Mercedes is the gardener of the family, she is unlikely to go digging under the rock, so the garden is actually quite a good hiding place. Daddy put the boulder in this spot. The year he decided to make it a rock garden, says Frances. Up to then, there was a scarecrow, but one night it pulled itself out of the ground and walked away. Lily pauses and looks at Frances. But Frances is calmly digging with a spoon, not using a spooky voice or anything. Nobody knows where it went. Maybe it'll come back and visit us some day if you're lucky, Lily. Anyhow, Daddy never made the rock garden because Mama died around that time, and he didn't have the heart to continue.
Around the time that I was born, eh?
That's right. You and Ambrose.
Frances, you said Ambrose was just a story.
I changed my mind. Frances, don't be a baby, Lily. Jeez, you're so easy to scare.
He was just a story, Frances.
All right, Lily, he was just a story.
He was, Frances.
Lily, you think what you want to think, and I'll think what I want to think. And if you're not mature enough to help me here, then we'll just burn your stupid drawing in the furnace, and Daddy will know about it. Is that what you want?
No.
Then quit whining about Ambrose. It was just a story. Silence. Lily, satisfied, picks up a spoon and digs obediently. Frances grins. No, he wasn't. Lily controls herself and manages not to respond. Frances starts laughing. They keep digging. Frances calls softly, Ambrose, Ambrose, Lily wants you. Giddy gales of laughter, prickly lights in her eyes and a little white stripe. Frances rolls over in the dirt and shakes her head and feet in the air like a dog and giggles demonically. The only thing to do when Frances gets like this is to ignore her until it wears off. Otherwise, you make it worse. Lily just keeps digging.
That's deep enough.
Frances is suddenly back in command. We don't want to dig up the bones of the orange cat. Lily draws back. She had forgotten about the cat. Now only inches below. Frances lays the scroll in the shallow hole.
Rest in pieces.
Lily looks up sharply, but it's okay. Apart from a gleam in her eye, Frances is safely this side of the verge. They each toss in a handful of dirt, then bury the scroll and roll the rock back into place. A perfect job. Just place these loose bits of dry corn husks around its base, and no one could ever tell in a million years.
Okay, Lily. Go on inside now. I'll be right there. What are you going to do?
I'm going to say a little prayer. Lily obeys. Out of the garden and onto the little footbridge over the creek in her steady, uneven gait, and whap! She catches a dirt ball right in the back of the head. She turns. Frances is doubled over in the center of the garden. She is off again. Oh, no.
Frances, come on. Someone will see you.
Frances runs in a crazy limp out of the garden, down the bank, and right straight splash through the creek, waving her arms, doing her impression of Lily.
Frances, come on! Come on, Frances!
Laughing, limping all the way back to the house. Lily follows slowly. Frances can't help it. Lily knows that. She just hopes Daddy hasn't heard them out at this hour. Because if he has, Frances will get a good talking to. And there won't be anything Lily can do about it, except to bring her warm milk after and let her sleep with Raggedy Lily of the Valley. But it's all right. Daddy is out. He isn't working. He just couldn't sleep. He went for a walk and wound up at the graveyard, longing for a drink. He drank salt air instead. Now, at dawn, he turns homeward, listening for the sound of pit boots along Plummer Avenue, expecting to hear the mine whistle. Then he remembers the strike. For no reason, his throat tightens. His eyes sting, but he isn't going to cry. There isn't time. He wants to be home when his girls wake up. Porridge.
Here, Daddy.
Breakfast. It's a new day, and the night is gone, and I'm here with my girls.
Thank you, Mercedes. Eat up, Frances.
I'm not hungry, Daddy.
Eat.
Frances skims her porridge. It's still hot underneath, but the surface has congealed to a thin skin, and a few viscous strands cling to the end of her spoon.
Don't play with your food.
It's cold.
Daddy gestures to Mercedes, who adds another steaming spoonful to Frances's bowl. Frances grimaces.
Men in the trenches would have given an arm for what you're turning your nose up at.
Frances pictures the severed arm. She sees an apple-cheeked young Tommy. He smilingly detaches one of his arms, sleeve and all, and says in a fetching Cockney accent,
"No harm done, mate. Can I have your gruel now?"
Don't laugh. Just stare down into the glistening gray muck. There are dead men under there.
I said, eat.
Frances places her spoon in her mouth. Snot.
Swallow it.
Who will save Frances? Lily is eating every bite of her own porridge, little brat. Is there any way to sneak some into her bowl? Will Mercedes intervene discreetly? Frances racks her brains for a diversion. She knows her throat will not open again. It will gag, and she'll spew, and Daddy will...
Answer your sister.
What?
Mercedes quietly repeats.
Are you all right, Frances?
Yes, thanks. It's really good, Mercedes.
Who will save Frances?
That godforsaken cat is in your garden again, Mercedes.
It's okay, Daddy.
It's digging.
He sets down his spoon.
We shouldn't eat a thing from that garden with that animal around.
Trixie never relieves herself there, Daddy.
Everyone turns and sees Trixie out the window, her tail bobbing around the rock. James tolerates Frances's cat because Lily is attached to the thing. But he's running out of patience, already composing a kind of lie about how Trixie had a long and happy life, but cats sometimes just run away. He gets up from the table. Frances watches him head for the back door.
Oh, thank God, thank Jesus, Mary, Joseph, and all the saints. I will never sin again.
She waits till he's halfway across the yard, then jumps up and empties her bowl into the garbage by the stove. Mercedes doesn't comment. But Lily looks suddenly worried.
"Relax, Lily. He'll never know," says Frances.
But Lily isn't worried about the porridge. She's been watching Daddy bending over the rock in the garden. He comes back into the kitchen but does not sit down. He stands at the head of the table with his arms folded and asks quietly,
"Who moved the rock?"
Frances feels sick. She knows now that life was easy when there was just porridge. Lily turns bright red.
I did, Daddy.
Nice try, Lily. Daddy strokes her hair. Mercedes is at a loss. If she knew what Frances's crime was, perhaps she could...
Perhaps I dislodged it while gardening, Daddy.
That was pretty lame.
I did.
Frances speaks clearly.
When?
Last night.
Silence. How is it possible to feel so cold and yet to be sweating at the same time? How long have we been sitting here? What's the big deal, anyway? Whack! Across the side of the head. I'll tell you what the big deal is.
Oh, no, Francis. You said it out loud. You thought you just thought it, but you said it.
The big deal is, you had your sister out in the middle of the night, and she could have caught her death of pneumonia.
Francis, so could I.
You have the gift of health. Your sister is delicate.
I'm fine, Daddy,
says Lily, and sneezes.
Francis almost grins, but Mercedes looks down. She does not believe in accidents. James has not taken his eyes off Francis.
What in God's name were you doing?
Francis considers and answers,
We planted something.
What?
Lily saves Francis.
We planted a tree for the family.
Mercedes looks at Francis as the penny drops. James asks Francis,
Under the rock?
It's a really strong tree.
Thank you, Lily.
James looks at Francis. He should pave over the garden plot and park the car on it. But that wouldn't seem right. He should dig up what's there and put it elsewhere. But he can't. And perhaps, after last night, it is no longer there. He looks at Francis. Surely she was too young to remember. But if she does, what kind of person takes her baby sister out at night to exhume infant remains?
Francis meets James's eye and says,
I told Lily that if we dug in the garden we might find treasure, but we didn't find anything.
James resumes his seat. He rests his eyes on the tea leaves at the bottom of his cup. Mercedes pours him some hot. He sips. Francis can't believe her luck.
Mercedes says a prayer of thanks and apologizes to God for being ungrateful about her family.
James says to Francis, Eat.
I've already finished, Daddy. Look.
So you have?
No. She could not possibly remember. Water babies. From breakfast on through all the day, at home among my friends I stay. But every night I go abroad, afar into the land of Nod. Robert Louis Stevenson, The Land of Nod. A very young Francis is standing in the creek in the middle of the night, staring out. At us, or at someone behind us. She is holding a bundle in her skinny arms. You can sort of almost see it from the corner of your eye, but you can't see it at all when you look right at it, like trying to look directly at a dim object in the dark. It's annoying. What is it? And just when you thought this was a still picture in black and white, the water around Francis's white nightgown lights up blue. The source of this light is a bright blue fish that's flicking and swimming about her ankles. It's beautiful. Lily wakes up screaming.
Lily! Jesus Christ Almighty!
Francis is blanched and staring at Lily's shell-shocked form, silent now and ramrod straight beside her in the bed. The overhead bulb goes on. It's James in a plaid panic.
What's happened?
Mercedes appears behind him, a new line hovering at her brow.
It's okay. She had a nightmare,
says Francis, petting Lily's rigid back. Lily turns and looks at James. He comes to her and picks her up. She wraps her arms and legs around him and lays her head upon his shoulder, eyes wide open. He rocks her gently from side to side, wondering a little at the recent rash of nightmares under his roof. Lily says,
I dreamed I was a fish.
Francis shivers. Mercedes smooths her temples.
In the creek, Lily continues. And I couldn't breathe. Mercedes heads down to the kitchen to make hot milk all around. Francis rolls over and rescues Lillian Gish from the ice floe. James leaves the room but returns a few minutes later, just ahead of Mercedes. He has Trixie. Trixie looks terrified, but knows enough not to move a muscle when in this particular embrace. He puts Trixie down gently next to Lily, who buries her face in the astonished black fur. When Mercedes passes around the warm milk, James pours a little of his own into his hand and offers it to Trixie. Trixie gives him a look, then bends and laps it up. "Do you feel better now, sweetie?" James asks. "Yes," answers Lily. Trixie curls up between Francis and Lily. James tucks them in and turns out the light. Back in her room, Mercedes is finishing Jane Eyre again. She was thankful when Francis returned her favorite volume, apparently unscathed. Now, with that mixture of satisfaction and regret with which one comes to the end of a beloved book, Mercedes turns the last page, only to find Francis's unmistakable scrawl on the flyleaf. It is an epilogue, wherein Mr. Rochester's hand, severed and lost in the fire, comes back to life and strangles their infant child. Mercedes closes the book and merely sighs. She is past weeping and gnashing of teeth. It is abundantly clear that her two sisters are working their way through everything that is of the slightest value to her and ruining it. Mercedes is resigned. For now. Some day she will marry someone wonderful. Perhaps not Valentino, but wonderful nonetheless. She will have her own family, and they will be civilized. Francis will be allowed to live with them, but it will be Mercedes' castle. And her husband's, too, of course. But not yet. Daddy needs her. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. If you were a fish, how come you couldn't breathe? Francis hasn't touched her milk. It's on the bedside table, wearing a wrinkled skin.
I was drowning.
Fish don't drown.
You were in it, Francis.
In the creek?
You were little.
I know.
What were you holding?
Nothing. I don't remember. Go to sleep. It was just a dream.
Lily's hand glows red around the Bakelite Virgin. Conductive scarlet threads beneath the line of life, of fate, heart, and mind. Her palm bleeding light. Later that night, Frances is awakened by a weight on her chest. She opens her eyes and looks into Trixie's intent face, staring into her own at a range of about an inch. Trixie's black paw hovers white-tipped and frozen in mid-air. A wizened, slimy strand of something like the throw-uppity bit of a raw egg dangles from the corner of Trixie's mouth. Francis blinks, and Trixie turns back to the glass of tepid milk on the bedside table, ignoring Francis, wiping her milky face, dipping and drinking. The first time Ambrose comes to Lily, he is naked except for the decomposing bits of Francis's old white nightgown in which he was laid to rest. The shreds cling to him here and there, fluttering slightly because there is a bit of a breeze when Ambrose arrives. Safe and soundless in his garden womb, he has not been dreaming because he has not been asleep. He has been growing. His body is streaked with earth and coal, but otherwise he is pale as a root. Although he is exactly the same age as Lily, he is full grown like a man, whereas she is still a little girl. This is because their environments have been so different. What color is his wispy angel hair beneath the dirt and soot? Reddish. He is standing at the foot of the bed. Francis is asleep. Lily is somewhere in between. She must be. To see such a thing and not scream. To see such a thing and know it can't quite be a dream. Because there is the foot of my bed. There is my sister sleeping. There is my rag doll. And here is Trixie curled between us with one eye open. And there is Ambrose. Although Lily does not yet recognize her twin.
Who are you?
Has she spoken this? She must have, because the man who is looking at her from the foot of her bed opens his lips to reply. And as he does so, water gushes from his mouth and splashes to the floor. Now she screams. Now she is awake, back in a state which is a definite place on a map. Here is the place called Awake. On the other side of this line is the country of Asleep. And you see this shaded area in between? Don't linger there. It is no man's land. Lily is safely back in Awake, and expects to see Francis's exasperated face looming over hers. She expects the overhead light to snap on for the second time, and for Daddy to pick her up again, and wonder how she could possibly have two nightmares in one night. But there is no light, and Francis is still asleep. Lily did not scream after all. Although the sound of her cry was enough to wake her up, it was apparently no more than a whimper, because the house around her is still breathing regularly, expanding and contracting, dreaming. And see, there is no man at the foot of the bed. There is no water on the floor, as there would be had he truly been here. Lily doesn't tell anyone about this dream, because it is too scary to tell. Even though the dream of Francis in the creek with the dark bundle and the bright blue fish caused Lily to cry out and wake the whole house, the dream of the waterman from which she awoke with a whimper was much more frightening. A Child's Prayer for a Happy Death. O Lord, my God, even now I accept from thy hand the kind of death it may please thee to send me with all its sorrows, pains, and anguish. O Jesus, I offer thee from this moment my agony and all the pains of my death. O Mary, conceived without stain, pray for us who fly to thee. Refuge of sinners, mother of those who are in their agony, leave us not in the hour of our death, but obtain for us perfect sorrow, sincere contrition, remission of our sins, a worthy reception of the most holy viaticum, and the strengthening of the sacrament of extreme unction. Amen. By Sister Mary Ambrose, O.P. Prayer for a Happy Death is from a children's paperback called My Gift to Jesus. The prayer is the last one in the book, which makes sense. The book was a gift from Mercedes to Lily for no reason. About 20 minutes ago, Mercedes came in and said, "Here, Lily, here is a little gift for you for no reason in particular." Then Mercedes went to Helen Fry's house. It's a hot, sunny day, and Francis and Lily should be down at the shore. Lily in the old English pram, and Francis pushing it on the run, careening over rocks and pebbles, splashing through foam, both of them screaming with terror and joy. But instead, they are dressed up in togas and turbans from the linen closet, confined to the house because Daddy says it's not safe to play outside. In fact, he has driven Mercedes over to Helen Fry's house on 9th Street, and he plans to drive her home again, too. The miners' strike has dragged into June and turned ugly. Special company constables have been on the rampage. Drunken goons on horseback wielding sticks and guns, knocking people down in the street. Women, children, it makes no difference. The bosses are now a monopoly called the British Empire Coal and Steel Company, BESCO. This time, not only have they cut off credit at the company stores, they've cut off New Waterford's water and electricity. For the past week, sweating bucket brigades have stretched from the few wells to houses throughout town.
At New Waterford General Hospital, children lie parched amidst a new outbreak of all the old diseases with the pretty names.
People can't haul buckets indefinitely with so little to eat to keep up their strength. And the resumption of the almost daily sight of small white coffins has convinced many that their last drop of strength might be better spent hammering the guilty parties. Once James dropped Mercedes off, he drove to Sydney to buy bottled water and kerosene, with strict instructions to the girls to keep inside. Apart from missing out on the sunny days, the girls haven't minded so much. It's been fun using only lamps and candles again, like in the olden days. Frances would venture out on her own. But Lily is so worried by this prospect that she has already sworn to tattle if Frances risks it. Having tired of playing Arabian Nights, Lily and Frances are now poring over My Gift to Jesus. Like her sister before her, Lily is already a good reader. But she hasn't had a chance to read the little book herself, because Frances grabbed it, turned to the last page, as is her habit with all books, and read it aloud. Lily has understood everything in the Happy Death Prayer except for one word.
"What's a viaticum?"
"It's a holy word for clean underwear."
"Can I see the book now, Frances?"
Lily reaches, but Frances pulls the book away and explains, "When you're about to die, and the priest comes and gives you extreme unction, he takes a set of clean underwear out of your drawer and blesses them. Then he puts them on you. Or, if it's an emergency and there's no priest, anyone can bless the clean underwear. That's where Fruit of the Loom underwear comes from. It comes from the Hail Mary when you say, 'Blessed is the fruit of thy loom, Jesus.'"
"Did I get clean underwear that time when I almost died when I was a baby?"
"Yep."
"Blessed by Father Nicholson?"
"No, by me." "Lily, look."
Frances has just noticed the name on the title page of My Gift to Jesus. This book was written by a nun called Sister Mary Ambrose. Lily gasps obligingly.
"Does she know our brother?"
"It could be a message to us from Ambrose himself."
Lily gazes in wonder at the title page while Frances deduces. "Ambrose is working through that nun, and he also made Mercedes buy this book and give it to you so you'd know he's watching over you." They look at one another, united by the discovery.
"Does he always see me?"
asks Lily.
"Yes."
"When I'm bad?"
"Yep."
"Is he going to tell God?"
"God knows everything anyhow."
"Oh, yes."
This had momentarily slipped Lily's mind. "Ambrose sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake."
"Like Santa Claus."
"That's blasphemous, Lily."
"Sorry."
"Don't tell me. Tell God."
Lily folds her hands, squeezes her eyes shut, and whispers,
"Sorry, dear God,"
following it up with a rapid sign of the cross. Making the sign of the cross after a prayer is as essential as putting a stamp on a letter. Otherwise, your message isn't going anywhere but prayer limbo.
"Frances, you know what? God is really Santa Claus, and Santa Claus is really God."
"No, he isn't, Lily."
"But God gives us gifts and knows everything, and so does Santa."
"Yeah, but Santa Claus doesn't give people leprosy and earthquakes, stupid. He doesn't give them the Titanic sinking or people getting their legs chopped off."